This is Mike Causey. Welcome to Your Turn. Glad to have you with us today. We're going to be tracking the money, as we always attempt to do. And my guest is John Grobe. He's extremely well known in the government benefits business. And he's going to be, he's a wealth of information. John is based out of Chicago. Correct me if I'm wrong, John. And you come to the D.C. area from time to time to do training for federal agencies.
Now, this particular trip to D.C., I'm coming to see my newest granddaughter up in Germantown.
Oh, all right. I thought you had a rendezvous with the FBI or something.
Well, I was supposed to, but the scheduling just got carried away. And the last thing I wanted to do was not come here and get to see the latest granddaughter.
Good deal.
She's
good
cute,
deal.
By the way.
Well, congratulations. They tend to be.
Yes.
I have five, by the way. John, I'm looking at you. You work, you're a regular columnist, I guess you'd call it, for FedSmith.
That is correct.
And I'm just looking at some of your more recent contributions. But before we get into that, because we're going to cover the waterfront here from TSP to Fegley, which is a timely subject. But before we do that, I want to talk about the stock market for a little bit. 2015 was not a good year. You had double-digit losses, if you view them as losses, in the C, S, and I funds. The only real winner was the G fund, the Treasury Securities Fund, which is not sexy, but it never has a bad day. This year started off, again, rocky, and we can blame the Chinese economy. We can blame a variety of things, but the low oil prices, which used to be good, and suddenly they're not so good. What's your feeling about a federal worker in the thrift savings plan now? Now, I know people would give different advice to a 70-year-old than they would to a 50-year-old or a 20-year-old.
Yeah, well, I am a federal worker, or I should say federal retiree in the thrift savings plan. My wife is a retired Fed, has a TSP account as well. So this is something that concerns us, and I certainly wish I had that crystal ball that would allow me to pick the right funds. What I think will work is either the good old buy and hold approach.
Yeah.
People in 2008, yes, they got hammered if they were heavily in stocks, but they gained it back and they're ahead of the game.
They were buying
right
low.
Now. They were buying low as they continued. And what I actually have started to do, I belong to one of those TSP allocation services. There are these services, several of them track long-term or mid-term stock market returns. The two I'm thinking of in particular, there's one called TSP Safety Net, and there's one called the TSP Strategist. One follows a 40-week return, one follows a 50-week return. And when the performance of a fund deviates from that particular chart, the particular rate of return, let's say that the C fund goes up, it would give you a direction, step into the C fund now because it's performing above its 40-week average. Now, I don't think this is a way to make anybody rich, but it is a way that would get you out of the market early in the event of another 2008. Now, I certainly hope we're not going to see another 2008, but in the event of another 2008, you'd get out of the market early, and in the event of a rebound, you would get back into the market early. I don't mean before the rebound. I mean relatively quickly after it, because the fund would start deviating on a positive side from those averages. It's a way where if the market is really volatile and it's up and down, up and down, up and down, you are not going to do any better following one of these than you would in a buy and hold. But in the event of the big one, then it will get you out earlier and will get you back in earlier. So that is what I as an individual do. Now, I'm obviously into my retirement. I tend to be more cautious. So in the allocation service to which I belong, I am in their conservative allocation. I would think someone who was younger would be in a more aggressive allocation and so on.
Well, one of the things that I hear all the time talking with financial planners, and I do talk to a lot of them, have over the years, don't pretend to be one, but I know, as they say, I know a number of them. And they say the getting out is not the issue. Anybody can get out when there was a when that volcano exploded in Iceland and blocked air traffic to Europe for a couple of weeks. You know, people got out of the market. You can get out for a lot of reasons. What the pros say, the problem is when to go back in. And there are some people who apparently went out, jumped out in 2008, so they sold low, and they're still sitting in the G fund.
And in their case, they probably would have locked in the losses. Now, one of these allocation services, odds are, would have you getting back in early in the upswing. It would have had you getting back in sometime in 2009, not right at the beginning, but very quickly thereafter. And you would have missed, or so was the theory, you would have missed the deep drop, and you wouldn't be stuck down there in the chasm.
There's going to be some changes in the FEGLI program, the Federal Employee Group Life Insurance Program. They're going to have an open season this year when people can re-enroll or enroll for the first time or whatever the reason, they can go back in. These are unusual. These happen, as you know, about every decade, and they only happen when there's a premium change. So what's the deal with this one?
Well, this is actually the 10th open season since 1954.
Wow.
So that's been a long time, and it's been 12 years since our previous open season. Basically, the big deal about an open season is that anyone can sign up regardless of their health. Someone who might not pass underwriting normally could sign up during an open season. Now, with FEGLI, there is a provision that someone can sign up or increase their coverage at any time whatsoever if they go through underwriting and if it has been more than 1 year since they waived their FEGLI coverage. But this open season, I think it serves a couple purposes. It lets people who might otherwise be uninsurable to get insured, and it brings FEGLI back out into the mind of federal employees because there's going to be publicity about it, and people will start thinking about their level of life insurance again.
So if you're in ill health or you have a medical condition, this could be a godsend for you and your beneficiaries.
Absolutely, it could be. But there is one issue with the open season, because they don't want someone who has 1.5 feet in the grave to jump into FEGLI. There is a 1 year waiting period before any changes in the open season become effective. So, for example, the open season is going to be this coming September of 2016. The changes will not be effective until the beginning of the first pay period in October of 2017. So there's going to be a year gap in the effective date. And of course, something retirees or people who will be retiring in the not too distant future need to consider. FEGLI, like FEHB, has a 5-year rule. You have to be enrolled for the 5 years immediately preceding retirement. So if I were a person who was thinking of retiring in the not too distant future and this open season came up, I would have to ask myself, am I going to retire before the first day of the first pay period in October of 2022, 5 years after that effective date of the beginning of the first pay period in 2017?
I'm really glad I asked you that. This is a significantly big deal at half a dozen levels, isn't it?
It sure is. FEGLI sometimes gets a bad rap, and sometimes the bad rap is deserved, in that the optional FEGLI gets more expensive every 5 years. And that continues when people go into retirement. So every fifth birthday, for example, I am at some time in the not-too-distant future going to turn the age of 70. Oops, there goes my FEGLI, up again. If I still have FEGLI when I make it the 75, boom, it goes up again, and boom, once again at 80. At least after 80, they don't increase it every 5 years, but it gets, many people consider, prohibitively expensive for your optional FEGLI. Your basic FEGLI, the costs in basic FEGLI depend on choices individuals make at the time they retire. as long as I'm working, my basic Fegley is not going to get more expensive for me unless my coverage increases due to salary increase.
Right, and you always have the argument, too, that in many cases you need life insurance most in your middle years, middle career, to pay off a house, pay off debts, to send the kids to college. And when you get in your 60s, 70s, and 80s, you may not need it, particularly if you're a government retiree, and maybe you, or in your case, you and your wife, who is a federal retiree, annuity and a survivor annuity.
You're absolutely correct. In deciding how much life insurance you should have, you should look at basically two things: how much money is needed to cover your final expenses, and how much money is needed to support the household. So if we've got a 35-year-old who's just bought a house with a large mortgage, has two kids in grade school, and a spouse who makes less money than he or she does, then you've got a situation where a large amount of life insurance might make sense. You go 25 years down the road where the mortgage is paid off on that house, where the kids are, God willing, grown, gone, and educated, the parenting trifecta.
Uh-huh.
And then you need significantly less insurance, especially, too, when you retire, you've got that pension coming in.
Very good. Okay, thanks. We're going to take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with John Grove. He is a He is a federal benefits expert. We talked about the value of Fegley, the federal employee life insurance program, and the fact that an open season is coming up, and this will be the first open season in 12 years. And John explained the reasons why everybody that works for the government should take a look at this open season. And some of you, this is a chance of a lifetime, if you will. So hope you heard that first segment. If you didn't, I hope you will listen to it. We're on our homepage here, so we can listen anytime and share it with a friend. John, I'm looking at some of the columns, if I can call them that, blogs, that you've written for FedSmith. And one of them here, you talk about the FEHBP 5-year requirement and your spouse. And this is one of those things that I'm sure every time you conduct a retirement seminar, when you mention this, there are some people who get a blank look on their face and a question mark appears above their head. They've never heard of it. What is the 5-year rule?
Well, with FEHB, and also with Fegley, any insurance for which the government makes some type of contribution, there is a rule that an individual must be covered for the 5 years immediately preceding their retirement. Now, that individual happens to be the federal employee. There is no requirement at all that a spouse be covered on FEHB before, 5 years before they retire. In fact, there's no requirement that a spouse even be covered when the employee retires. The spouse can be brought on at any time during that employee retiree's life. And an issue with spouses that's related to FEHB, it ties in with the choice of survivor benefit from your federal pension, your CSRS or FERS pension. In order for a spouse to continue coverage in Fegley after the employee or retiree's death, the spouse must have been enrolled on either a self plus one or self and family policy and must be receiving a survivor annuity. Many retirees, at the time they retire, they're given the choice. Do I want to get a survivor benefit for my spouse or don't I? Now, if I choose to not get a survivor benefit for my spouse or to get a less than full survivor benefit for my spouse, I need my spouse's signed notarized consent. Now, this can be an issue because this tie-in between survivor benefits and the ability to carry over health benefits for the spouse after the employee retiree's death is relatively unique to federal employment. And individuals dealing with financial planners who are not familiar with federal employment can sometimes get advice that really doesn't suit them. Many financial planners, particularly those who sell insurance, are fond of talking about something that in their trade is referred to as the pension max. I bet you a lot of listeners out there who have hit the age of 50 or past the age of 50 find invitations in their mailbox to go to free lunches, free dinners, and so on. And one of the things that they will be taught in those dinners, according to those flyers, is how to increase their retirement income by 10%. And I know exactly what the financial advisor will say. They will say, you can increase your retirement benefit by 10% during your lifetime by not electing a survivor benefit for your spouse. That's absolutely true under FERS. And under CSRS, the savings may be a little less than 10%, but it's basically true under CSRS as well. However, if an employee makes that choice, chooses not to get a survivor benefit for their spouse, and then that employee slash retiree, I guess I should say retiree, dies, that spouse, even if they were on a self plus one or self and family policy, will not be able to continue FEHB, which can be a big deal. So this is a misconception that a lot of financial planners have about federal retirement
right.
and benefits.
And I guess some of it is because they simply don't know the rules. And in some cases, they know the rules, but they're selling a different service. And the idea, you said the key word back there, you don't have to have your spouse, your non-federal spouse, on your health insurance in order to put him or her on later on. But you have to be alive to do it, correct? If you predecease them and they're not covered, that's it, right?
Absolutely. You are correct.
Okay, that's very interesting, and I did not know that the 5-year rule applied to Fegley. That's really interesting, and particularly with an open season coming up. Talking about one of your columns recently, you talked about funding your retirement accounts in 2016. What was that all about?
That account, I believe, was about what I call front end loading, where an individual who was going to retire this year could, assuming they could afford it, accelerate their TSP contributions. You're allowed to contribute $18,000 over the year. Now, if I were going to retire on December 31st, I would spread that $18,000 out over the entire year. That's somewhere in the vicinity of $690 a pay period, give or take a few bucks. On the other hand, if I were going to retire on June 30th, and I could afford it, I could make, in effect, double TSP contributions. I would divide the $18,000 elective deferral amount by the number of paydays that I'm going to have in the year 2016 before I retire. Let's say I'm going to retire at or about the end of the 13th pay period. Well, then I'd be looking at an amount somewhere around $1,380 a month. I'm sorry, a payday that I could put in, and I would max out my TSP as of the day I retire. Now, of course, not everybody has $1,380. This kind of goes back to one of my favorite old sayings, it takes money to make money.
Okay, it's like people who resent paying taxes. It's a nice problem to have if you have a heavy tax bill. It means you're doing something right.
Absolutely.
Talking of taxes, you did a column for Fed Smith called "Tax Traps for Federal Employees to Avoid" or "How to Avoid Tax Traps."
Yes, I did. There's a lot of issues with federal income taxes and. With the tax traps, thanks for passing it along, with federal and state income taxes, a lot of them deal with something that is known as the estimated tax penalty. An estimated tax penalty will occur when not enough money is withheld from your retirement income. If you have withheld by the end of the tax year less than 90% of what your actual tax bill was, with few exceptions, you are going to have to pay a 10% penalty, 10% of the difference between what you should have had withheld and what you did have withheld. And there are two big tax traps, not so much dealing with your pension, but dealing with Social Security and dealing with the Thrift Savings Plan. Under Social Security, there is no withholding for federal income tax unless the individual applying for Social Security requests it. So let's say I didn't request it and I got $20,000 a year in Social Security and nothing was withheld. I'll have a nasty surprise around April 15th. Also, there's another issue regarding the TSP. The most common TSP withdrawal choice, according to TSP statistics, is substantially equal monthly payments. It's where an individual chooses an amount of money that they want each month. They're allowed to do this, and they receive that amount per month for the next year. Then there's another open season for the next year, and they do that. Well, the TSP's default withholding is as if married with three dependents. Now, I ran this by a friend of mine who is an expert in federal retirement benefits and does happen to have a CPA as well, Dan Jameson. And what Dan told me was using the basic tax tables, you would have to be receiving from the TSP somewhere in excess of $1,500 a month before they would start withholding. So you have a person there getting substantial money from the TSP with nothing withheld. The first year of their end of the first year of their retirement, if they didn't withhold Social Security and did not request extra withholding out of the TSP, not only would they owe a ton more money than they thought they would, but they would owe a whopping estimated tax penalty.
Yeah.
Now, you're always going to have to pay your taxes,
yeah,
but you can avoid penalties. As many people have said, tax avoidance is perfectly legal. In fact,
yeah,
years ago I worked at the IRS, and one of our jokes was, what's the difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion? And the mm-hmm. answer was, oh, maybe 10 years in prison.
Yeah, yeah. And so, no joke. Yeah, and this could give you a tremendous tax bill. And I also wasn't aware of the fact that they give the assumption that you have five deductions, two spouses and three kids. That's amazing.
One of the TSP publications on their website, you would go down to the forms and publications section and then find the area on withdrawals. It's one of the four or five tax notices they have. On the third page has a detailed full page table showing the default withholding for every particular type of TSP withdrawal. That should be required reading for anyone who is approaching retirement.
Good deal. That's good to know. Thank you, John. We're going to take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Clausey here. I'm talking with John Grobe. He's a retired federal worker and a longtime federal benefits expert, and some really interesting information in the first part of the show, and a number of things that I wasn't aware of, and I follow this pretty closely. It was very, very interesting. John, the question every federal benefits expert eventually gets asked, in some cases it's the most asked question, to paraphrase Shakespeare, you know, to be or not to be, and that is, when you retire from the federal government, should you take Medicare? Part A, it comes with the territory, but Part B is something you pay for. How do you answer that?
You know, that is literally the most asked question
mm-hmm, I'm sure.
that I receive in email inquiries from FedSmith readers or from others who track me down on the internet. It's interesting. I was talking to a colleague who does seminars for law enforcement retirees who very often retire at age 50 and could retire even younger. He says that question isn't even on the radar screen of those people because they're 15 years away from the age of 65. In my classes, when I'm not doing classes for law enforcement officers, I'll have people approaching Medicare eligibility. I'll have people who are working past the age of Medicare eligibility. and you see different takes on should I or shouldn't I get Part B. For listeners who are members of NARF, the National Active and Retired Federal Employee Association, I hope I didn't butcher that too badly.
I think you got it right.
But people who are members of NARF, they have an excellent discussion of it on their website. Now, you'd have to be a NARF member to access it, but the correct answer is one that is the correct answer for a lot of federal benefits, and that is it depends.
Yeah.
You know, it depends on a couple things. I think one is your expected future health, and another is your ability to pay those extra Medicare premiums. This year, for people who are retired or not retired for that matter, the Medicare premium for those who are collecting Social Security, Medicare Part B, remains $104.90 per person per month. Those who are not what they call held harmless, that's someone like me who's a CSRS retiree, mm-hmm. or it's someone who is not having Medicare Part B premiums taken from their Social Security, and I may be off on the cents on this one. I believe it's $123.70 mm-hmm. per month. So you're looking at, if it's a couple, anywhere between $210 and $250 extra dollars a month for Medicare. So I'm paying extra money. What am I getting for my extra money? Well, most federal plans, and please note I said most because not every yep. federal plan coordinates with Medicare the same. And of course, I think we're both assuming that everyone out there knows Medicare isn't effective till the age of 65. But I do want to get that out there.
I bet they don't, yeah.
That it's not effective till 65. But most of the large fee-for-service and preferred provider organizations, if an individual elects Medicare B, that FEHB plan is going to pick up Medicare Part B deductibles and copays, and they're going to waive their own deductibles and copays. So you've got a situation where I'm paying that extra premium because I took Part B, but as long as I'm going to Medicare participating physicians, I am having absolutely no out-of-pocket for covered expenses. I do an example in my classes using two people I know. One is a fella who's he does retirement classes for other organizations, and he does some for mine. He is going to turn 80 this coming October. Now, he is the most active age 80 I have seen. You'd walk down the street, and those of us of a certain age would appreciate this. You wouldn't think he was a day over 62.
That's right.
You know, young.
Like young fellow.
Active, healthy, but his chronological age is up there. And he counts beans. He mm-hmm. is very financially focused. He never took Medicare B when he was 65. And he has kept track of how much he has saved mm-hmm. in Medicare premiums versus what he has paid in deductibles and copays. And he is way ahead of the game.
Yeah.
On the total other end of the spectrum is my late Aunt Dorothy. She was a retired Fed, and she was a member of what physicians would call the worried well.
Yes.
She wanted, if there was a test out there, she wanted it. She took her annual physicals at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. You know, she mm-hmm. had every test known to man. And she, in some years, she once showed me a statement from the Mayo Clinic where the total bill was close to $17,000. And her share of that bill was not one red cent because she had Medicare Part B and she had her FEHB. So she came out ahead. It depends a
right.
lot on how healthy individuals think they will be and how much they can afford in those premiums. And it also depends how their current plan interacts with Medicare. I would say required reading for someone approaching 65 should be the Coordination of Benefits section of their FEHB plans brochure, as well as a booklet that they can get on the Medicare.gov website. It's updated every year, and it is called Medicare and You. After people read those two, they'll get a better idea of how their plan is going to work with Medicare, and then they'll be able to make that decision, a much more informed decision, when they look at what they think their future health will be and what they can afford. And of course, our future health, that's as much of a wild card as how long we're going to live.
And
we
don't know. The other thing, too, and I hate to be the proverbial wet blanket in this, but people are always talking about health. You can, at age 19, step in front of a bus. You can, at 23, fall off a roof. You can trip over a dog on the street. So you're talking about health and accident, you know, the thing. the belt and suspenders theory I have is that your frugal 80-year-old friend who's kept track of what his out-of-pocket was versus what he would have paid in Medicare Part B premiums, and he talks about the savings for that. Well, if he really saved it or invested it wisely or did something with it, if it just became part of his regular income, seems to me that's not as big a deal as opposed to the belt and suspenders thing, but having total coverage. Your friend who went to the Mayo Clinic, $17,000 bill, paid nothing. My mother was a longtime government worker, retired a long time. She was extremely healthy up until her last couple of years, and then the dementia hit. But she had she was belt and suspenders type, and she had Medicare, and she had federal health insurance and everything. And our expenses, our being mine and my children, in helping take care of her, were minimal. Because of that, and that kind of brings me maybe to the long-term care insurance thing. Long-term care, a lot of people don't think about it. A lot of people don't want to think about it. The interesting thing to me is that back when I got my policy at the Washington Post many years ago, there were 24 companies that underwrote long-term care programs. And we got ours in a group plan through the Washington Post. Very good deal, very good company. Since that time, virtually all of them have gone out of the business of long-term care insurance. They found it's way too expensive. It's not worth it. People are living longer. People are getting more expensive treatments. What's your feeling about long-term care insurance?
Well, there are two categories of people who should not buy long-term care. Those who have enough, I didn't mean to say buy. Mm-hmm. There are two categories of people who should not consider buying long-term care. Those with net worths of over a couple million dollars who would be able to fund long-term care out of recurring income for a long, long period of time, or those with net worths of less than $150,000 or so who might find themselves on Medicaid relatively quickly due to the cost of long-term care. But you made a very interesting point about the companies that were in business and aren't anymore. Most of them are still servicing their policies. But one of the reasons a lot of them get out is assumptions they initially made were incorrect. And we saw this in our own federal long-term care back when we had that, not the initial open season, but the second open season, back when MetLife became one of those companies that dropped out. We only have John Hancock underwriting ours now. We can get to this more after break.
Okay, take a break here. Here at federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. I'm talking with John Grove. He's a federal benefits expert. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with John Grove. He's a well-known federal benefits expert in the field, writes a column for FedSmith, and he's been kind enough to join us here today live in studio. And John, we were talking about long-term care insurance before we left, and a financial planner that I know says that, to the best of his knowledge, Christopher Reeves, who played Superman, you know, he was a multimillionaire, top of his game. He had an accident riding a horse, jumping a horse. was paralyzed, was hospitalized for a number of years, had the best of care, obviously, went broke. And his wife had been an actress, and she went back to Broadway to try to make money to make ends meet. And that's pretty scary when you talk about having a sufficient nest egg to take care of yourself. You may not know how long that's going to be required, and it doesn't do much for your survivors if they're of a certain age.
That's another one of those wild cards in financial planning. You can become disabled at any time, and if, like with Christopher Reeve, this ability lasts for a significant period of time, you could go through a significant pile of money doing that. Though the average, this is a statistic, and I wish I could remember where I found it, the average stay in a nursing home is less than 3 years.
Yeah.
Some people go in and die relatively quickly once they're in there. So it's another one of those wild cards. People who can afford long-term care premiums yet don't have the amount of money to continue paying for it out of private funds for a long period of time might be well served looking at long-term care coverage for a premium. I hate to say it, but I think it's for an ever-increasing premium.
Mm-hmm.
You are going to be covered for as long as you need it. And I just want to talk briefly about the ever-increasing premiums.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have, I believe we're on schedule to have, a long-term care open season in 2017. I will be really interested to see if John Hancock raises the premiums or changes the policy. In our first open season, the policy was slightly changed and the premiums went up an average of 25%. Now, this is not a rap on John Hancock, because virtually every company that has long-term care coverage will increase that cost each contract period. The way John Hancock phrased it, and I got this off the LTCfeds.com mm-hmm. website, was that the initial assumptions they made were they underestimated the number of people who needed care, they underestimated the cost of care, they underestimated inflation, and there's also wording that says specifically that if premiums are determined inadequate by John Hancock and OPM agrees, those premiums can be raised. Now, they've only been raised at open seasons thus far. So that's why I'll be really interested to see what it is. Several years ago, I read an article in Kiplinger's Retirement Report where a financial planner stated that when talking with his clients about long-term care coverage, he told them that if they could not afford a premium that was twice that he was quoting them, they probably shouldn't be considering long-term care. My own personal opinion is that we'll continue to see increases in long-term care premiums at each contract period until long-term care coverage has been around for a while. When you look at the world of insurance, long-term care coverage is relatively new. It's not like casualty coverage that's been around since the late Middle Ages. It's, last 30 or so years.
Well, and when I got into it with our group plan, they did not have anything for inflation adjustment. And they offered you, as you said, coverage for 2 years, 3 years, for life, if you will. But this is sort of the law of unintended consequences at work. Every advance in medical science, every new piece of surgical equipment, every new treatment, advances in delaying Alzheimer's and the impact on you, every one of those means those are dollar signs flying out the window for somebody. It means you're going to be living longer, and you're going to be kept alive longer, and in a situation where you're going to have to pay somebody every day.
Yeah, excellent point. And in talking about insurance, let's talk about long-term care, and I'll just kind of move Fegley in here too. With group coverage, it's based on kind of everybody's health. If I am generally healthy and I am a woman who tend to live longer than men, that's an issue more for life insurance, I might be able to get a better premium on a similar policy outside of the government group insurance. I think it pays for people thinking about insurance to shop around. So when that Fegley open season pops up, take it as a time not to just look at your Fegley, but look at perhaps competitors to Fegley, other insurance companies that might provide something similar, compare benefits and costs. Those who are female and generally healthy might find they can do better outside of the group plans.
Yeah, and WEPA would be one of those that's known to a lot of federal workers because it was started during World War II by federal employees for federal employees, and they do provide insurance. And if you're younger and healthier and a woman, you can get a much better deal premium-wise from them than you can from Fegley. But the reverse side of that is if you're not very insurable otherwise, then Fegley is a godsend for you. And this upcoming open season is the best thing that's happened to you in a long time.
Absolutely. If I were not in good health, I would really consider jumping on Fegley in the open season. And for long-term care, just hopping back to that briefly, even if they have an open season, that does not mean that anybody can sign up. They are going to have to go through underwriting. The only time people could sign up for federal long-term care without underwriting was way back when it was first introduced. There was a limited period before they even announced what the plans were that people could sign up with no underwriting. Back in roughly 2010, we had a brief open season with limited underwriting for federal employees, their spouses, and partners.
Talking about partners, you did a column recently on the changes in long-term insurance for opposite-sex partners. What's that about?
Well, the long-term care program, when it was first set up, was for spouses and for same-sex partners. Opposite-sex partners were kind of left out. So opposite-sex partners have been added to the long-term care insurance. So an opposite-sex partner could be covered. Because long-term care, the federal program, it doesn't just cover a federal employee. My spouse could sign up as long as I'm a federal. I'm sorry, I don't want to say sign up. My spouse could apply and go through underwriting. My parents could apply. My children can apply. And now, not only might a same-sex partner be able to apply, but an opposite-sex partner would. And you know OPM, they came up with a long list of what constitutes an opposite-sex partner, which is buried somewhere in their regulations.
The devil is always in the details in those things. And we kid OPM a lot about these regulations, but Congress just says, make everybody equal, and they pass the law. But when you turn it over to a federal agency to make that work, it's very difficult.
I'll say it's one of those things where you really need to dive deeply into it. That's one reason I'm still doing pre-retirement seminars, because some of these things are so confusing, you need to explain them to people. It's not something someone's going to pick up by osmosis, being a federal employee.
If this stuff was easy, you and I would not exist, or we'd have other jobs. John, just a quick wrap-up here. Is there such a thing as a pre-retirement checklist that you would check off for people?
You know, I would suggest that people wanting to know things they should do as they approach retirement, go to the OPM website. They have a list of what you should think about 5 years before retirement, 3 years, 1 year, 6 months, yeah, 3 months at the time you retire. It's a detailed list, and of course it's written the way only OPM could write it, but it has almost everything a person should think of as they approach retirement. OPM.gov, go into the retirement area and use the search tool. You'll be able to find it.
Well, good. And a point you made earlier, too, there's a different end game for different people. And people who are permitted to retire early, law enforcement, air traffic controllers, large number of federal workers are allowed to retire earlier than the norm. They may pay more for it, but those people need to look at things further down the road, like the Medicare Part B.
Absolutely. The Medicare most recent trustees report, the one for was August or sometime in 2015, said Medicare would be solvent until, I believe it was 2024. So if you're not going to be 65 in 2024, you could, and my math skills have just deserted me at this very moment.
But I didn't bring mine with me. So.
But subtract the age of 65 from 2024, and you will see the year of, I hope you people out there are using your calculators, whatever year you see there. Let's just say it was 1954.
Mm-hmm.
If you were born after that date, there's no guarantee that Medicare, as we know it, will be there for you. So if I'm in my 40s and 50s, I don't want to worry about Medicare. The time that people should start thinking about their Medicare choices is as they approach 65, like the Beatles said, when I'm 64.
Yeah, very good. Thank you, John Grove, for being with us today. And thanks for listening. And remember, our shows are archived on our homepage, so you can listen to this one or any show at any time you want at your convenience and pass it on to a friend. Have a good week and stay safe.